We see Taro as an important step in Bitcoinizing the dollar, getting the best of both worlds by 1. Issuing assets like stablecoins on the most decentralized and secure blockchain, Bitcoin, and 2. Allowing users to transact on the fastest global payments network with the lowest fees, Lightning. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we have got tons to dig into. So as everybody knows, Bitcoin 2022 was nuts. There were tons of announcements to dig into, and I'm trying to figure out Taro. That is kind of has been my focus the last 2 days while I finish up a bunch of other stuff and work on the room. But Taro is issuing assets on top of Bitcoin hidden within the Taproot script so that there's absolutely no blockchain bloat in doing this. It's, in fact, from the perspective of the blockchain, it might as well not exist. It's just behind a signature just like anything else would be. And then also the ability to actually send these over the Lightning Network. It's a really, really interesting set of tricks. And I'm trying my best to wrap my head around it. I've read the announcement. I have watched Alalu's or Roast Beef's presentation from the open source stage at Bitcoin 2022 three times maybe. I don't know. I've gone back and re-listened, you know how he is when he talks. It's so hard to actually discern what he is saying because he talks so damn fast. So I've been trying to make sense out of that, and I'm digging through the spec on GitHub right now as well. But there's no way I'm going to be able to fully wrap my head around it today, so I figured the best way to start this off, this is absolutely going to be 2 episodes. I'll have a guy's take tomorrow, probably, depending on how other things go and get finished. But I will have a guy's take trying to my best to explain the inner workings of this, how this thing works. I hope to understand it by then. But today we are going to go through the announcement, and I want to talk about what it means and kind of an overview of how I understand it so far. So the announcement is, this is written by Ryan Gentry. This is all from Lightning Lab, so it's on lightning.engineering, their blog. And this is... simply put, this is a really big deal. This is a really big deal, and I think this is going to be really incredible to see how this unfolds, because I did not see the scope of what Taproot was going to make available in this way, because it's essentially taking what we are able to do with op return data and creating our own metadata for any other tokens or sidechain tokens that we want to actually send on Bitcoin or US dollar stablecoins, and stablecoins really are the focus here. But it's basically able to do that without any op return data, or with op return data in a sense, something akin to that, except hidden within a Taproot script, so that it's just not on chain. I mean, it is on chain. You prove it by checking data on chain, and it's still secured from double spending with on chain expenditures, with on chain scripts. But the data footprint is basically non-existent, which is just, it's just, the whole thing is crazy. And like I said, I'm still trying to wrap my head around it. So let's not waste any more time in setting this up. Let's get into the announcement, and then I'll have a short guy's take on, as best as I can, give an overview of this, and then we'll really dig into this, hopefully tomorrow. All right, with that, real quick, thank you to our wonderful, wonderful sponsors. We have the BitBox O2 hardware wallet. I just got 2 more, so I'm up to 3 BitBoxes now at Bitcoin 2022, and I'm excited to actually use it with Nunchuck, the multisig wallet, which is not a sponsor, but I've been playing with it a lot recently and I'm loving it. So get yourself a safe, secure hardware wallet. That's the Bitbox. And then obviously, how are you going to put coins onto that? How are you going to get your keys? How are you going to get your Bitcoin onto that Bitbox? You're going to stack automatically and you're going to automatically withdraw with Swan Bitcoin. SwanBitcoin.com/guy. That is my referral link. And you know what? Actually, technically, Swan Bitcoin isn't. We've just used up. We've finished the contract, so they're not even a sponsor anymore. But I love Swan Bitcoin, so I'm going to keep shilling Swan Bitcoin. SwanBitcoin.com/guy. Okay, with that, it's time to get into today's read. And it's titled, Announcing Taro, a new protocol for multi-asset Bitcoin and Lightning, by Ryan Gentry. Today, we're excited to announce Taro, a new Taproot-powered protocol for issuing assets on the Bitcoin blockchain that can be transferred over the Lightning Network for instant, high-volume, low-fee transactions. This announcement marks a big shift to a multi-asset Lightning Network with the potential for the world's currencies to route through Bitcoin liquidity on the network. At its core, Taro taps into the security and stability of the Bitcoin network and the speed, scalability, and low fees of Lightning. Together with the new protocol, we're also announcing our Series B fundraise to further build out Lightning Network infrastructure and help number of people go up. Taro enables Bitcoin to serve as a protocol of value by allowing app developers to integrate assets alongside BTC in apps both on-chain and over Lightning. This expands the reach of Lightning Network as a whole, bringing more users to the network who will drive more volume and liquidity in Bitcoin, and allowing people to easily transfer fiat for Bitcoin in their apps. More network volume means more routing fees for node operators, who will see the benefits of a multi-asset Lightning Network without needing to support any additional assets. We see Taro as an important step in Bitcoinizing the dollar, getting the best of both worlds by 1. Issuing assets like stablecoins on the most decentralized and secure blockchain, Bitcoin, and 2. Allowing users to transact on the fastest global payments network with the lowest fees, Lightning. Taro relies on Taproot, Bitcoin's most recent upgrade, for a new tree structure that allows developers to embed arbitrary asset metadata within an existing output. It uses Schnorr signatures for improved simplicity and scalability, and importantly, works with multi-hop transactions over Lightning. To that end, we are releasing a series of Taro Bitcoin Improvement Proposals, or BIPs, for feedback and comment from the developer community, as it is an open protocol for the community to adopt. You can learn more and read through the full Taro specification on GitHub. Why does Lightning need more assets? Last year brought an explosion of growth to the Lightning Network. New users from all around the world, but especially Latin America, especially El Salvador, Guatemala, Argentina, Brazil, and West Africa. Examples, Nigeria and Ghana. Experienced, instantly settled, low-fee, peer-to-peer transactions without financial intermediaries for the first time. We've continually heard from people, developers, and startups in emerging markets such as Galloy, Strike, Ibex Mercado, Paxful, and Bitnob that adding stablecoin assets to the Lightning Network would expand financial access for their communities. Taro enables wallet developers to provide users with a US dollar-denominated balance and a Bitcoin-denominated balance, or any number of assets, in the same wallet, trivially sending value across the Lightning Network just as they do today. Importantly, as more users are onboarded to Lightning wallets through fiat, they will be able to easily acquire and use Bitcoin. This is what bringing Bitcoin to billions looks like. How does a Taro transfer over Lightning work? Imagine Alice and Bob have a Lightning USD or LUSD channel with $100 of capacity, balanced such that they both have $50 worth of inbound liquidity. And Carol and Dave have an LUSD channel with $100 of capacity, balanced such that they both have $50 worth of inbound liquidity. If Bob only has a Bitcoin channel with Carol, Alice can still send $10 of Lightning USD to Bob, who charges a small routing fee in Bitcoin and forwards $10 of Bitcoin to Carol, who charges a small routing fee in LUSD, and forwards $10 of LUSD to Dave, the final destination. Taro interoperates with the existing Bitcoin-only Lightning network as is, only requiring the first hop and the second-to-last hop to have Lightning US dollar liquidity. This structure taps into the network effects and liquidity of today's Lightning network to route any number of assets, avoiding the need to bootstrap an entirely new network for new assets, and ensuring that Bitcoin underpins all transactions on the network. It also incentivizes the growth of Bitcoin liquidity within the Lightning network to serve a broader multi-asset Lightning network. Where does Taro come from? Taro makes use of the new Taproot scripting behavior, available on Bitcoin as of the soft fork last November, to allow developers to embed arbitrary asset metadata within an existing output. This means no additional burden on full nodes, no burning of Bitcoin via the op-return opcode, and that Taro assets inherit all the same double spin protection of normal Bitcoin transfers, along with the additional functionality like transferability over the existing Lightning network. Because the Lightning network is a payment channel network, it has faster settlement and lower fees than other blockchains, and retains those properties as the network scales. Bringing stablecoins to Bitcoin via the Lightning network is good for users who want access to financial services, good for app developers who want new tools, good for routing node operators who want more fees, and good for issuers who want a better experience for their users. For more deeper technical details of the Taro protocol, you can dive into the protocol BIPs, link included. In a nutshell, the major benefits of such a modern Taproot native design are scalability. A single Taproot output can contain an essentially unbounded amount of Taro assets. Programmability. Taro assets have an unlocking script, similar to normal Bitcoin UTXOs, enabling developers to program transfer conditions into said assets. Auditability. The special tree structure used by Taro allows efficient supply audits both locally within a given wallet and also globally within the chain for an issued asset. Usability. Asset-specific addresses enable wallets to be smart enough to prevent users from sending the wrong asset by mistake. How do I get started? The first step in getting Taro out to the world is releasing the draft protocol and its underlying components in a series of BIPs, and getting feedback from the community at large. The second step is to build the tooling that allows developers to issue and transfer arbitrary assets on-chain. The final step is to build functionality into Lightning that allows developers to open channels with Taro assets that can be sent over the existing Lightning network. We are working on all three and invite the community to contribute. We are incredibly excited for companies building on the Lightning network to be able to integrate this new protocol, be it via integration into apps or tools, or the ability to issue assets on Lightning and let users all around the world harness the security and decentralization of the Bitcoin network with assets like the US dollar. While much of the motivation for this protocol comes from enabling fiat stablecoin value transfers over Lightning, Taro, as proposed, is a general asset issuance and transfer protocol, and it can enable both fungible and unique assets. We hope readers will review the Taro proposal, read our documentation, contribute to the code, and most importantly, build the world's monetary network with Bitcoin. All right, that wraps up the announcements. The announcement of the Taro protocol from Lightning.Engineering by Ryan Gentry here. So let's take a quick break and hit our sponsor, and then I want to talk about what this means, or at least what I think this means, and hopefully kind of set the stage as we dig into how this works tomorrow. Simple, secure, and it works. That is all you need in a hardware wallet, and that is what you get with the Bitbox O2. You know, people have really strong opinions about hardware wallets, and I am one of those people who subscribes to the idea that you just need one. You just need one that works and that is simple to use, because it is a thousandfold increase on your day-to-day security if you're using a hardware wallet. But it doesn't hurt to have one of the best. It doesn't hurt to have one that looks amazing. It doesn't hurt to have one with rounded corners, just in case. And that's why I'm a huge fan of the Bitbox. That's why I bought two more at Bitcoin 2022. Because you can never have enough Bitboxes. And you'll find out that when you're using multisig and that you have one too few Bitboxes, that's not a good place to be. You want more Bitboxes so that you can multisig the right way. And you can get 5% off all of your Bitboxes by going to guyswan.com/bitbox and typing in those three wonderful letters, G-U-Y. That is my name, and it'll get you 5% off everything in the store. guyswan.com/bitbox. All right, so I've talked about stablecoins quite a bit on this show in the past. I don't think I've discussed it a lot recently, but one idea that I've always thought was fascinating about stablecoins, and why I think they're one of the few things from a token issuance perspective that actually have some sort of value, is that it makes banking look a lot more like the traditional banking system that we had in the late 1800s and early 1900s before we basically institutionalized the monopoly of the Federal Reserve, but as of money as a collective debt rather than an institutional debt. So a banknote traditionally was a banknote specific to the bank that issued it. Like J.P. Morgan would have a J.P. Morgan banknote that was backed by J.P. Morgan gold in the J.P. Morgan vault. And you could actually have price differences between the banknotes, because the banknotes were actually just redemption for real specie, for real money that was backed by it somewhere. So the note was, I mean, that's why it was called a bank note. It was issued by an institution. And what's interesting about stablecoins is that it's re-decentralizing this. We still have, obviously, the fundamental, like, systemic problem of the dollar being just total shit. But manipulated and at risk of the incredible manipulation of the price of debt, because new dollars are issued as debt. And we kind of have this fundamental mathematical problem where if you issue new money as debt plus interest, which you issue new money into existence, like you issue $1 million into existence, and it's debt where somebody owes $1 million plus 10% back, well then the economy is in a perpetual state of trying to catch up. There's never enough money really to pay off all the debt. You're just in a mathematical hamster wheel. There's nowhere to go but credit crisis, basically. Or this perpetual inflation where you're this slow poisonous incentive where you are draining the value from everyone who saves and produces, and transferring it to everyone who consumes and takes on as much debt as possible as quickly as possible. and that accelerates with time so that it gets worse and worse and worse the longer and longer that it goes on, because the incentive obviously is to get more and more debt at lower and lower rates, and it because it's the only way to actually keep the system propped up and keep it from collapsing entirely, that's what they have to do. They have to get more and more debt. I mean, look at the deficits of the United States government. Look at the debt charts. They all, and you know, cut the end of it off. Go back to the 90s, go back to the 2000s, go back to, like, and then compare it to now. It all looks like a hockey stick, but then the next decade looks like a hockey stick, and the previous hockey stick looked like it was non-existent. You know, it used to be a big freaking deal in the late 90s if the government printed $20 trillion to do some huge campaign or some, you know, huge you know, subsidy and all this stuff. It seemed like an absurd amount of money, but now we talk about like $2 trillion, $4 trillion, like it's no big deal, like it's not 1,000 times larger than the thing that was just a problem, which is a huge problem just 20 years ago. So that's kind of this perpetual system that we're stuck in. So stablecoins don't fix that. That was a tangent to say stablecoins have nothing to do with that problem, but they do help deal with the overarching problem. Like for instance, I think there are a strong pushback against CBDCs. I think the idea of stablecoins and commercial banks, because people forget that in a CBDC world, commercial banks get fucked, like really bad. They have a lot of incentive to push to make sure CBDCs don't happen, because they essentially become redundant if individual users, if consumers can actually have CBDC accounts, and we're talking about digital money, especially if they are incentivized, if they, essentially the political apparatus wants them to have those accounts because they can have more explicit, direct surveillance and control over the citizenry, you know, social credit scores. We're going to pause your money if you're, you know, buying too much beef and your carbon footprint is too shitty. So in that scenario, you're basically removing the commercial banks from even having a role in the economy. So I think they're actually, there's a lot of incentive for them to push back. And one way that they can actually do that is to push for stable coins, to basically obsolete the supposed argument for CBDCs from a consumer benefit standpoint of, well, you can use it easier, you can transfer it, it's, you know, like it's programmable, you can do all this fun stuff. Well, you can do that shit with stable coins. So you can have all the banks issue their own stable coins, and they can move them around the world. Now, so stablecoins essentially begin to mimic the 1800s banking system, the traditional banking system with banknotes and individual institutions, where one institution's banknote, like let's say Lehman Brothers issued a Lehman Brothers banknote back in the you know, early 2000s, is that note alone collapses. Whereas all of the other notes from the banks that stayed solvent do not. And it also lends to, because we're increasingly in a digital world, and I think Bitcoin is going to be the foundational money here, you when you look at it from kind of Nick Bhatia's layered money thesis and how he lays out how the monetary system has become this layered system from monetary abstractions down to the base layer, and how when you have a crisis, people rush back to the base money. You actually shorten the tower. You shorten the distance and the time it takes to get back to specie, to get back to the fundamental monetary unit. So when we're looking at this as a comparative to a new layered money system, stablecoins just become a short-term intermediary that with both systemic risk and also liability risk of a singular institution. You know, say you're holding a lot of JP Morgan digital dollar or whatever, and JP Morgan has a terrible crisis. Well, you want to get the fuck out of that. You want to get back to Bitcoin. So, but that shortens the distance, the ability to immediately and quickly switch between the quote unquote, the more widespread, the softer monetary unit back to the harder monetary unit means that insolvencies, imbalances work themselves out far, far faster than they otherwise would. So I have seen stablecoins as like a natural evolution of this, and they actually make sense. And it's one of the only things in all of quote unquote crypto, albeit the obvious centralized nature of it, like there's no getting around of it, to say stablecoin is almost invariably means you're talking about something centralized, something that is not inherent to the blockchain. Like Bitcoin can't secure anything that is not Bitcoin. Like Bitcoin is the only thing created within the rules of Bitcoin. Therefore, any asset put on top of it, and all this stuff happening with Taro is irrelevant to that, because any degree of decentralization or centralization or federated asset or issued asset or stablecoin, whatever, is kind of irrelevant to the discussion, because this is just how to manage and create those assets in a system that allows you to leverage Bitcoin's consensus mechanism so that they can't be double spent. But this obviously does not mean they can't be inflated. It doesn't mean that you can at least check the supply. You can audit them because it's on the Bitcoin blockchain. But but basically all it's leveraging, it's using Bitcoin for, you know, its original idea as a timestamp server. It's using it for its time chain. But one thing that's really fascinating about this kind of protocol specifically in Taro and how it actually allows the movement of these assets is that it's kind of like a protocol level upgrade or change or just a system of metadata for doing exactly what Strike is doing as a service. And I'm not saying that this will actually make Strike obsolete. I don't really think it does. In fact, I actually think this is something that Strike could leverage to make Strike far more efficient and far better at what it does. But so Strike is actually using stablecoins, right? They're using, I think it was Tether. I think they may be integrating another one or something. I don't know. But they're using this on the back end to make some of their transfers so that, and then they use Lightning itself to settle the individual payments on the front end for the user. So the design of Taro is such that as long as the last channel, the person you're sending it to, and the first channel, the person sending it, has the asset and the stablecoin within their UTXO, and the sender and the receiver agree on a SAT price, a price in SATs of that asset during transfer, they can route it through the Lightning Network in a totally non-custodial fashion, which is the same way that essentially Strike does it. It's Strike is settling dollars from app or service, and this is what they did when they're partnering with the NCR, is they're letting you pay Lightning, or you pay dollars from Strike or anywhere, like, you know, any of these other potential services can actually do this. And this is what's fascinating about something like Moon Wallet or Breeze Wallet or Phoenix Wallet, these like Lightning wallets that you could potentially actually have dollars held in those that literally sent those over the Lightning Network to fulfill a Strike invoice and turn it back into dollars on Strike's end for the merchant or for Whole Foods or for Walmart or whatever it is, whoever they're fulfilling payments for. And the beauty, and I'll talk about a little bit more about this when we actually hit this explicitly on the show, because this probably deserves its own episode, or at least the dominoes are falling guy's take, which is very, very soon now, is that NCR is actually, or Strike is actually getting around the payments infrastructure part of things by actually partnering with NCR to fulfill the payment by attacking the software. So they aren't actually, they're literally attacking the terminal. They're, because you don't have to partner directly in order to update the payment. Oh God, how do I explain this? You don't have to, Bitcoin is only software. Lightning is only software. So if you can get into the payment terminal, you can just skip the payment processors in doing so. And it's a fascinating little like Trojan horse or like little workaround to make that work. And to basically skip having to deal with them at all. It's really fascinating to watch all this play out, because what we're seeing is Bitcoin becoming the medium of exchange. We're moving from the store value phase to the payment network phase, to the settlement phase, where Bitcoin is actually being used to facilitate payments from all of these other things. But what's hilarious, or actually, it's not hilarious. It's not funny at all. What's fascinating or just incredible to think about is this is exactly how you increase and create substantial amounts of liquidity on the network, because you have constant buys and sells within the market of people transferring Bitcoin to settle dollars, to settle other assets, to settle stable coins, whatever it is, to pay for Whole Foods. I send dollars, they receive dollars, but Bitcoin was essentially purchased and sold during that transfer. And you could essentially have outflows or inflows into Bitcoin, where somebody is paying, like I'm paying dollars to Whole Foods, but then Whole Foods is actually receiving Bitcoin, where a merchant is actually accepting and keeping it as Bitcoin. And then you can have the reverse, outflows of Bitcoin, where I am actually spending Bitcoin and it's immediately being transferred into dollars. And when you think about money as the good, like what makes the money of a society, is it's the most liquid good. Liquidity is the value of money, is that it's the thing that is so liquid, that is so ubiquitous, that is so useful in so many different contexts, that it becomes the most widely traded good. Therefore, it's the thing that everyone wants to hold in the place of the other goods they want in the future or at a different location, you know, across space and time. Everybody knows all that shit. So when you think about Bitcoin, or excuse me, when you think about money as the most liquid asset, this is one of those things that adds enormous amounts of liquidity and builds up that medium of exchange phase where it can be a massive settlement and payments layer for the entire globe with no borders, with no delays. Everything happens essentially instantly in some form or fashion. And then when we get on the other side of this, that is exactly the liquidity that will make the unit of account possible. It's exactly what allows the stability and the liquidity to get great, to get so... To, Benny, quiet, buddy. It's exactly what allows the liquidity to grow so much and to become so robust that it's actually stable in value. Or not even so much that it's stable in value, but that it's so stable in supply and compared to every in comparison to everything else, that it simply becomes the metric. So whether or not it's stable in value is just a reflection of the economy as a whole. So it doesn't really matter. We don't see the changes. Like, you know, nobody thinks, oh God, you know, the dollar is super volatile today when the price of bread is, you know, on sale for 50%. You're not thinking about it in terms of dollars. You're thinking, oh shit, the price of bread is volatile today. So that's essentially what changes when it becomes the most liquid asset. And because its reach is essentially infinite, its total market, total addressable market is everything, you know, Knuts von Holm, everything divided by 21 million, right? It's almost inevitable that as long as it stays sound money, as long as it stays censorship resistant, as long as it does not die and it stays independent, it will be. It just will. Like, that's the goal. Those are the goals. Now, one other thing, I've kind of got off topic here. I haven't specifically talked about Taro much, but one other thing that makes this really cool is that this is actually a better approach than Synonym is taking with John Carvalho, is that they were trying to build essentially this on Omni, which is kind of the same thing. In fact, RGB, I think it's Giacomo was building with RGB. I could be wrong about that. I don't remember exactly who the people in the project, the RGB project were. But RGB is essentially another thing very much like this. So Omni is tokens and stable coins and such on top of Bitcoin. I believe it's used in OperaTurn data. The metadata is dealt with in the OperaTurn. RGB is another protocol that's the same thing. And in fact, I think I was speaking with some other people about this, and this actually uses some of the things, it piggybacks a little bit on top of RGB, which, if that's the case, it would have been nice if they had kind of given a little bit of a shout out, because RGB's been working on this for a while as well. Somebody said that the name actually used to be CMYK, which is the opposite of RGB. Like, if you know your colors, RGB is the, what is it? Which one are they? Are they the adjective, the additive, and the CMYK is the subtractive? Shit, I can't even remember now. I think CMYK is subtractive, subtractive colors. But if you don't know, but the subtractive colors are like paint. You mix them, you know, you mix colors together and they get darker, and you mix all the colors together and you get black. Additive colors are like light. You mix them together and they get brighter, and you mix them all together and you get the color white. So anyway, random side note. So taro is, the beauty of taro is that in comparison to Omni, in comparison to what Synonym has been trying to build and what John Carvalho has been working on, is that Omni requires bootstrapping an entirely new network. A completely unique Lightning network that where you have to have the asset in a channel, and you have to have a channel explicit to that asset, and you need routes and liquidity with that asset. Whereas, and you could do, you know, atomic swaps with that, and you could have certain nodes that were willing to fulfill that payment with sats. But that's this whole other layer and additional protocol on top of it, and you need nodes that specifically know, you know, what the value is and need to swap. Whereas the beauty of taro, it seems to be here, and I haven't really dug into. I'm still having a difficulty with the explicit, like the very specific pieces of this and how it works. Like I said earlier, I'm digging into it, and hopefully we'll be able to explain it soon. Hopefully tomorrow, but. The beauty of this one is that it's natively, the way it's designed, compatible with the Lightning Network as is. So the Lightning Network, as it is right now, is a payment network for stablecoins the second they get issued on taro. And what's funny is that this is Bitcoin maximalist being right again, is that eventually everything's going to move to Bitcoin. And Bitcoin is going to win because it's the most reliable time chain and the most reliable settlement system and the most reliable monetary instrument at the end of the day. It's the most trusted, because this makes like 50% of the altcoins so unbelievably redundant. I mean, they already kind of are in a lot of ways, but this fundamentally makes stablecoins on all the other shitcoins arbitrary. And just like we saw with Omni, the original, when Omni was a shitcoin, which Omni is actually a protocol, but then it was also Omni the shitcoin. I know it's confusing. Crypto is stupid. But they had their own blockchain and everything and their own protocol. I think it started as MasterCoin originally. God, I don't remember. The history of these things is so absurd. Maybe that's worthy of a Shitcoin Insider episode. I know to the five people who listen to Shitcoin Insider, I know we haven't had an episode in like a whole year. But the show is not dead. I swear, we talk about it. We will have episodes. And I love you for being the five people who listen to that show, because it still has a, you know, a little corner of my heart. But Omni had basically all of the Tether traffic. Then when it basically became a little bit too expensive, it jumped ship. They just moved right over to a new blockchain, and then it was on Ethereum. Then it was on Tron. Like, and if you look at the amount of traffic on each one of these, it's just completely shifted over time. So when a lot of these, this quote unquote crypto was essentially designed to have a utility as a network, and that this utility completely arbitrary or completely indifferent to the value of the unit as a money and the security and the trust of it as a monetary good, it was attempting to bootstrap value by just being a network. And it just kind of proves how arbitrary that is, how you can't go in reverse. Like, and the analogy I always use is that you can't make dirt more valuable by putting smart contracts on it. Like, the smart contracts are desirable because you're trading something of value. Like, dirt doesn't become the value of gold because it's got the better payment network. You know, you can have the fastest payment network in the world. Visa could settle dirt at unbelievable speed. Dirt is lighter than, dirt is useful. Dirt is lighter than gold. Why wouldn't you just use dirt? And if we built the Visa payment network out to transfer little packets of dirt, Well, shit, wouldn't dirt become more valuable because it was so easy to transfer? No. No, obviously not. The value doesn't go in that direction. The value, first there is a thing of value, then you build transfer networks, then you build settlement, then you build contracts and, you know, complex agreements with it. And yes, that does add value to it, but only because it's more accessible in the market, not because the value of the thing is fundamentally different or the value proposition has changed. So the fascinating thing about Taro is there's no blockchain footprint. Like, and I'm still not quite wrapping my head around it. In fact, something that Lao Lu said in the conversation, in the video that he did on Bitcoin 2022, or not the video, the speech, which I watched the video, was that it's essentially a series of Taproot transactions within a Taproot tree. So it's Taproot within Taproot. So they've basically copied and pasted within the Merkle tree of a single Taproot script a whole setup for creating Taproot transactions within it. And there's this really kind of difficult to wrap my head around complexity in interacting between sparse Merkle trees and Merkle sums. And what was the, how did the unit audit work? God, I can't remember. I'm gonna have to go back to my notes. I tried to explain this to myself and then tried briefly to explain it to my brother as well to see how well I understood it. Obviously I'm not there. I lost my train of thought almost immediately, but I'll get there and hopefully I can explain the technicals for all you nerds out there, pretty relatively soon. But the fact that there's no on-chain footprint and that this works natively with Lightning, like, this is one of those things where we just don't realize how much Taproot is going to change things. The ability to create unbounded complexity within a single Taproot transaction, like, essentially what is being claimed here is that you could issue, within a single Taproot transaction, you could issue the entire ecosystem of shitcoins and altcoins. Like, which just is a redundant statement of shitcoins. You could just issue all of them on Bitcoin in a single transaction. Now, obviously, you'd never want to do that, and doing anything like calculating the signature and all of this stuff would be an absolute freaking nightmare. This, I'm not saying that that's a smart thing to do, or that it would have all the functionality, or that everything would be the same. But the fascinating element is that is the power that you can do with Taproot. So the amount of complexity and branching that you can do within this, and the number of different data structures and metadata and time locks and alternatives and various keys that you can do and stack within a single signature is unbounded. You can do it practically indefinitely. And that is a fascinating thing. And we just don't understand all of the things that will be possible to build with that when you can start to create these sorts of arrangements. Like, you could have a federated setup within a single key. And like, there's a serious potential that you could run sidechains like this. And God, it's so crazy. It's so crazy how much this is going to move very, very quickly. And I think every shitcoin that, you know, has boasted that, oh, we can run stablecoins on top of us, and that was damn near their claim to fame, is going to be in a bad spot. It's going to be in a really bad spot because, like it or not, it's coming back to Bitcoin. Now, the trade-offs. What's the danger? What's the risk of having non-Bitcoin assets issued on Bitcoin? This is where things get kind of hairy, because it's a bittersweet, right? There's a lot of great things that can happen with this. Credit is not going anywhere. Like, credit is a critical part of any economy, and to be able to issue credit for a business, or equity for a business, It's a clear use case. It's a clearly valuable thing that an economy needs. And what I think it makes sense that we would end up using Bitcoin as the consensus model for this, as the double spend protection, like as the time chain. Like, that is what Bitcoin does. That is fundamentally the power of this technology. So it makes sense that it ends up there. But when you end up in a contentious situation, when you end up in a block size war, assets that must be scarce, that necessarily, like equity or whatever, it becomes a risk. It becomes a unknown factor or an increasingly mode of influence over which direction the Bitcoin network takes. So during a contentious hard fork, you have a problem. Imagine if Coinbase had issued USDC, you know, $100 million, $1 billion worth of USDC onto the Bitcoin chain before the block size war, and then doubled down and said we were only going to support big block Bitcoin. Well, when Bitcoin forks, those stable coins exist on both chains at the same time. There's quote unquote $1 billion on traditional Bitcoin, and then there's $1 billion on Coinbase Bitcoin. They now have an incredible amount of influence over which network or which fork becomes the quote-unquote accepted or dominant one, because they can make $1 billion worth of value that people within the Bitcoin space are holding vanish, because they only have $1 billion. If they're one-to-one, if they're actually fully reserved, which their Coinbase, I wouldn't trust them to do that. But regardless, they're supposed to have a reserve of $1 billion for $1 billion in stablecoin. If there's now $2 billion in stablecoins on two separate forks of the same network, they have to pick which one that $1 billion exists on. Now, the reason, so this is a risky trade-off. Now, the reason it might not be as much undue influence as it may seem like at first, is that the underlying value, and like for the same reason that Tether being on Tron is not a risk to Bitcoin right now. Like, they could say, oh, we're only going to use Tron. It's like, nobody cares, right? Like, the value of Bitcoin remains the value of Bitcoin. And if we decide which Lightning Network is the one we're running nodes for, and we decide, and this is actually kind of the beauty of Taro over Omni in the situation of this, or in the scenario of this hard fork, this imagined hard fork with Coinbase coin, is that I will not keep my node running for a Lightning Network on Coinbase Bitcoin, right? Is that my Lightning Network is going to have a bunch of nodes, is going to have a bunch of channels and a bunch of liquidity, and I'm going to have multiple things, and I'm going to accept Lightning payments and stuff from like other merchants, and I'm going to pay merchants, and I'm going to pay people like other peers and all this stuff. But when the network forks, I'm not going to spin up a shitcoin. I'm not going to spin up a Bcash node and run my Lightning Network over there. So they will not be able to settle through my node. Their Taro stablecoin, their USDC, will no longer get the benefit of my liquidity. So whereas on Omni is that if I have an explicitly stable coin channel, well, then they can just make that channel disappear from me. So my channel just will only exist on one of those coins. Whereas when we're looking at Bitcoin as the settlement layer, well, then you've still got this user-activated soft fork sort of calling their bluff, where if the Lightning Network infrastructure does not support their fork, well, then it doesn't matter if that $1 billion of stablecoin disappears, because everybody's just going to dump it for stablecoin, for somebody else's stablecoin, or for Bitcoin on the Lightning Network that will actually settle their payment, because the Lightning Network becomes useless if all of the nodes running the Lightning settlement layer running Lightning nodes and opening up and maintaining all these channels ignores their chain. So it's not like a set in stone, like, oh God, this makes Coinbase just control things. But it is an interesting new dynamic. And this is also, you know, it's not too unlike the scenario where you're paying kind of like the BIP 300, you know, like drive chains, which I still go back and forth on. But when you're paying fees to, you know, a side block or whatever, is that you're changing, you're altering the fundamental incentives. Not a lot, you know, but if more people are using the drive chain as opposed to the base layer, and let's say there's 10%, 20% of fees on that side chain, and that side chain has huge blocks, you know, gigabyte blocks, well, then the maintainers of that side chain, the quote-unquote nodes that do exist on that side chain, can essentially reject or lie about what the accurate fee is to any of the Light clients, and in doing so, they can essentially make mining unprofitable for anybody who is not also also mining the sidechain. So anyway, it's always important to consider the attack vectors, to consider the trade-offs and the incentives that come in play with this. But regardless, stablecoins are here. I think stablecoins are a net benefit to the banking system, to a world that needs to transition to Bitcoin. And like I said, I've always liked the idea that we would kind of bifurcate and turn back into a banknote system where credit, quote unquote, credit from banks were priced individually, were priced in isolation of each other, where each bank had their own stablecoin. I think that is a far better and easier to keep the incentives right for a banking system than our current one. And that's obviously not discounting the fact that systemically everything is still just completely subservient or susceptible to the Fed's manipulation and the government and you know, printing all that crap. So none of that really changes, but it is at least an interesting incremental update and push into the world that I think we're heading into. And Taro is really a fascinating protocol, and I hope to really be able to wrap my head around it, kind of like I did with Lightning. But Lightning Network took me like probably 3 or 4 weeks to really, really feel like, oh, I can totally explain this to somebody. Hopefully Taro doesn't take me that long. Taro seems at least a little bit simpler, but Taproot and, you know, Merkle tree signatures and stuff is anything but straightforward in some regards, especially with all the complexity that you can actually build into it. I wish there was an easy visualization. Maybe there will be soon, but anyway, I'm just ranting at this point. So we will be revisiting this, hopefully sooner rather than later. I am still working my way through it, and I just finally got my theft applications done with the government. You know, you got to pay your fair share of the wars and economic destruction and lockdowns and increasing poverty. So I did that. I paid my fair share. But we will come back to this. I have so much to dig into and so much to cover. Like I've said a number of times recently, my backlog is quite absurd at this point. Stay tuned. And my studio is still in disarray, so I'm sitting here on the bed like the good old days. You know, the first episode was done with me sitting on my bed in front of my iPad and talking into my iPhone. And today I am sitting here with my laptop and with my new mic, holding the mic in my hand. You know, it feels good to kind of, you know, go back to the roots of the show. Thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you to the Bitbox and to Swan Bitcoin for sponsoring this show, and all you guys for being fans and learning all this shit with me and, you know, exploring Bitcoin. It's a crazy space, and this shit does not slow down. It is always fascinating. So with that, thank you so much, and I will catch you on the next episode of Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, and until then, everybody, take it easy, guys. You have been listening to Bitcoin Audible, a 111 production.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.